All right, let's get this talk started. It is entitled Natural Language Steganography and an AI Complete Security Primitive. And now would be the time for somebody to take out Rüdiger Weiss for a beer, if he's in here somewhere, because of all the crap I'm going to talk about. Because seriously, I won't be able to make any strong claims about the security of this scheme, but I really hope that my talk will be very interesting and inspiring for a lot of you. So the results I'm going to present are based on a final year thesis that I carried out last year. It is called Towards Linguistic Steganography, and it is available on my website here, bergmeier.cjp.net. And if you're interested in the topic, then please refer to this report, because it is a lot more detailed and scientifically more accurate, I would say. The other publication was the one I did this year in September at the Information Security Conference. Let me start out by challenging our view of cryptosystems. Cryptosystems are designed to protect our sensitive data against evil adversaries. Wrong. Well, maybe not. But then again, what is evil? So we're confronted with an ethical question here, right? And I would say that in almost any account of hacker ethics, we have to say that hacker ethics is about a good individual in a bad society, right? Thereby, I do not mean to say that our society is completely messed up and everything around us is evil, but I would like to say that the possibility exists. And much in the same way that we assume that a thesis will be false in mathematics unless we prove that it is correct, and much in the same way that in lawmaking we say in dubio pro reo, so if you can't prove that somebody's guilty, then he will necessarily be innocent. And the direct philosophical antithesis to this kind of normative ethics that we're dealing with would be something I'm tempted to call witch hunt ethics. So this is about a bad individual in a good society, right? We don't question what public opinion makers and lawmakers are doing at all, but the only thing we have to be afraid of is all the terrorists out there. And what does this have to do with our crypto system, right? A crypto system is designed to protect our sensitive data from adversaries like an evil spy intercepting sensitive communication, military communication or something like. A criminal fraudster trying to replay your banking transaction or something the like, or a nosy neighbor who wants to read your mail. And does this really involve a good individual in a bad society? I don't actually think so, because these threat models involve this evil spy, this criminal fraudster, this nosy neighbor, right, who has no control over the communication channel that Alice and Bob are using. So really we have to take the step towards stego systems, where we actually hide our data, right? We hide it from sensitive adversaries like an evil government censor infringing on our right to freedom of opinion and expression, or a greedy employer trying to limit our access to computers or something like. And I believe this does involve a good individual in a bad society, right? If we think of governments, if we think of employers, then these are people that actually make the rules. These are the ones that make the rules that Alice and Bob have to play according to, and this is why they control communication channels, right? So evil spies, criminal forces, and nosy neighbors do not control the communication channel. But evil governments and greedy employers do. And this is really a major shift in perspectives that we have in cryptographic system design, because Alice and Bob do not control the communication channel. It is actually Wendy the Warden who does. And the idea of Wendy the Warden was first introduced by a guy called Gustavus J. Simmons, and he depicts the communication setup as follows. Alice and Bob, right, the ones transmitting their messages, are arrested. They're in prison, and their only means of communication after they're locked up will be by way of messages conveyed for them by trustees, who are known to be agents of the warden, right? This is what Wendy stands for. However, since he has every reason to suspect that the prisoners want to coordinate an escape plan, The warden will only permit the exchange to occur if the information contained in the message is completely open to him and presumably innocuous. So in this scenario, we actually have this kind of witch hunt ethics, right? Alice and Bob are presumably evil unless they have all their communication open to Wendy the warden, who is actually the one deciding upon what they're doing. And we have to think of what happens if Eve, the powerless eavesdropper, intercepts a secure cryptogram. Right, if the cryptography software is secure, then nothing will happen. Because an evil spy or something the like won't know the sensitive communication. A criminal fraudster cannot read the banking transaction, and a nosy neighbor won't see the contents of your mail. But if Wendy the warden, who is something who has control, who has power over you, intercepts communication he doesn't like, then this can have serious consequences, right? Witch hunt ethics will assert about the bad individual in the good society that Alice and Bob have something to conceal if they use cryptographic methods. Basically, the greedy employer will probably fire Alice and Bob, and the evil government will send Alice and Bob to Guantanamo Bay or maybe Siberia. Yeah, this is maybe better. This is all, you know, historic hypothesis, nothing that is going on at the moment. It's just a number of thought games. So as long as there is a way for Wendy to tell ciphertext from clear text, Alice and Bob will not live in peace. And I had actually thought that this was a hypothetical scenario, but actually just yesterday in the talk by Mr. Schumacher, I heard that France has already deployed laws against strong cryptography or something the like. I will have to check on that myself. But basically, we believe we all agree on the fact that Alice and Bob can use steganographic methods rather than purely cryptographic ones in order to hide not only the content of a message, but any evidence of its very existence. And this is where the difference between a cryptogram and a steganogram comes in, right? A steganogram is always a package of data that appears innocuous to Wendy the warden. Are there any questions so far regarding the ethical motivation of why we use steganography, why this is an important topic? Because otherwise I will continue right into the technical stuff. What is innocuous? In the simplest case, Wendy has a list of innocuous cover symbols. So she could have a set and enlist a number of sentences she Wendy will not find suspicious in any way. Mitchell is a nice little town or a great little city or something the like. And if Wendy the warden finds a message inside this set, then she will know that the message was innocuous. And Alice and Bob want to transmit messages that are not in this set, right? Alice may want to send Bob the message, "I don't like Wendy." So instead of enlisting these sets, we can do that a little bit more efficiently. Because it is sufficient if we know one sentence that is innocuous, like Mitchell is a nice little town. And then we have a number of sets of words that can be used synonymously. That means by interchanging the word nice for great, fine, decent, or wonderful, or any of these words, or the word city by town, we never actually change an innocuous sentence into one that will be suspicious. This is why we might think of the scenario as follows. Mitchai is A, and then we have a choice for one in five different symbols, little, and then a choice for one in two different symbols, and of course, if we can choose one of multiple symbols, then we have found a carrier of information. And in this case, we can use it for steganography. So if we assume that Alice and Bob actually want to exchange arbitrary bit strings, then we can do the following. We can assign code words to the word choices. So if Alice wants to submit the message 101, then she sends Mitchai is A, then she looks up inside her code book the decoding of 10, which is fine, and then little town, and thereby we have encoded the secret message 101 by Mitchai is a fine little town. Keith Winstein and Mark Chapman have already built stego systems that work similarly to this. But unfortunately, these stego systems are pretty easy to break because of a number of statistic characteristics of a secret message. In a certain way, the distribution of symbols inside a steganogram shows through. So what I'm talking about is we have this fragment of the sentence, is a little city, or something of the like. And as soon as Alice wants to submit 101, she has to submit, is a fine little town. And Wendy can now count the number of occurrences, right? She will have one occurrence for fine and one occurrence for town. And then the next message will be transmitted, and Wendy goes on counting the occurrences of different words. And in any case, the result will be that she's left with a uniform distribution, so that each of these words appears with a constant probability. So nice happens to be chosen by the stego system just as frequently as decent or fine or great, and the same thing with the alternatives for city and town. But what about native speakers actually using that language? In this case, somebody might say to you, Mitchai is a nice little town. And again, counting the occurrences of different words, we will see statistic characteristics that are, in fact, representative for the English language or for the way English native speakers use their language. They might use the word nice much more frequently than great or fine. And this is why, looking at this distribution, Wendy can actually distinguish the steganogram from innocuous communication. And this weakness is due to our use of block code. If we think of the scenario as this, we have a long bit string, and it is a concatenation of code words, each of which is of length 2. Then, of course, the probability that we find a certain code word of constant length inside a uniform distributed bit string will always be constant. In this case, it will be 1/4, because the probability for the substring 00 to occur in a uniformly distributed string will be 1/4, because it is one of four possible choices, namely 00, 01, 10, and 11. This is a random choice. But we can overcome this limitation by using variable length codes. In compression algorithms or something the like, in the Huffman code, it is often used in that way that a code word does not have a fixed length, but it can have a variable length, and it will be uniquely decodable as long as it is prefix-free. And in this case, where we have one code word that only consists of the zero, we know that in one of two cases, a bit will be zero, because there are only two bits. Right, so the probability for zero to occur will exactly be 0.5. And in the case of a code word, word of length 2, like the 10 we have here, the probability will be significantly lower. In this case, it will be 0.25, because 10 is a choice from one in four possible alternatives. And this is how we can emulate word choices of different probabilities. And Peter Wheeler actually showed how we can use this technique to approach any kind of distribution that we like in such a scenario. Now, what we've seen so far is called mimicry. Mimicry only provides a way to turn a secret message into an innocuous-looking cover. And to know whether our scheme really is steganographically secure, we have to introduce something like a cryptographic one-wayness property. In other words, we have to ask ourselves the question, if it is trivial for Bob, the legitimate receiver of a message, to decode it, then why shouldn't Wendy, the warden, do the very same thing? What I'm thinking about is this. Alice wants to submit the plaintext message, bridges out. And then she uses the mimicry technique to turn this into something innocuous looking, a piece of text that says, "Dear Grandma, we're having a lot of fun here at the summer camp." And of course, there will be truly innocuous covers, like a real kid really writing home from summer camp, "Dear Dad, summer camp sucks, get me out of here." And it will hardly be possible for Wendy to distinguish these two things, because that was the property we were talking about earlier, that a cover really appears innocuous and the steganogram cannot be distinguished from a real cover by any means. But what Wendy can do is she can reverse this mimicry, right? She can apply the inverse of this mimicry function. And if she applies the inverse of the mimicry function to the real steganogram, then she will be left with the plain text message, breaches out. And if she reverses the mimicry on the piece of text that has not originated from a stego system, then she will be she will be confronted with some useless random crap. And of course, she can't distinguish these two things. So actually, she has a way to distinguish between a steganogram and an innocuous cover, even if we have perfect mimicry. And this is why we can use a cryptographic layer in between. The first thing Alice does is she uses an encryption method, preferably a homophonic cipher or something that really produces something random looking, to turn her plaintext message bridges out into a randomly looking message. And then she applies the same mimicry to the cryptogram to get something innocuous looking. Again, we have the scenario that Wendy cannot distinguish the covers, but of course Wendy can reverse the mimicry. But in this scenario, it is a lot more difficult, because reversing the mimicry on a steganogram always yields this randomly distributed bit string. And a cryptogram from a homophonic cipher is a randomly distributed bit string, and reversing the mimicry on an innocuous-looking cover also yields a randomly distributed bit string. So when you can distinguish this, what you would have to do would be to break the encryption, right? Because breaking the encryption on the cryptogram, or decrypting the encryption, in the case of Bob looking at the contents, will yield the original plaintext message bridges out. And decrypting a piece of crap will produce another piece of crap. And in this case, Wendy would be able to actually distinguish this, but we have reduced the problem of creating information theoretically secure steganography in the presence of perfect mimicry to the problem of breaking a crypto system. So it will be just as hard for Wendy to break the stego system as it would be for her to break the crypto system. And now for something completely different. I was talking about linguistic steganography and an AI complete security primitive. And so far, we haven't regarded this AI completeness property at all. What is the basic idea behind this? Is to use a linguistic problem. But let's first look at how the Shargon files define the term AI complete. AI complete, from the MIT and Stanford lingo, by analogy with NP complete, used to describe problems or subproblems in AI to indicate that the solution to a problem presupposes a solution to the strong AI problem. That is the synthesis of a human level intelligence. A problem that is AI complete is, in other words, just too hard. And of course, we can think about NP completeness in terms of a complexity theoretic limit imposed on our solution to the problem. And if we think of AI completeness, then we actually think about something like an ontologic problem. Like, we have empirical data saying that this problem is an extremely hard nut to crack. And the idea is the following. Humans can easily solve any AI complete problem, right? Humans can understand text. Humans can understand the contents of images. And humans can filter natural language voice out from background noise or something they like. And computers cannot. And what we're doing when we're using this in the context of a security problem is to assume that Wendy is a computer. And if we think about this, then this scenario is quite likely to happen. Because if we think of large-scale steganalytic efforts, like some government sensor trying to look at every mail and looking whether it contains any cryptograms we don't like, then it won't be able for them to do that with human resources, right? We need a computer, we need fully automated, we need completely formal ways of deciding these things. And now if reversing our steganographic embedding yields an AI complete problem, then Wendy is truly in trouble because she cannot reverse the encoding. And by chance, we can construct such a system by the linguistic problem for disambiguation. Now in this context, I would have to introduce to you the linguistic problem of word sense ambiguity. If we think of synonymy, then we can say that in a maybe talking about an article or a book that may go through an editorial process or something like that, it should move, run, or go through several more drafts. So we can use this word interchangeably in this context. Or if we talk about an article, then we could say this article must move, run, or go through copy editing or something like. And we would be tempted to conclude from this linguistic evidence that the synonyms for the word move are move, run, and go. But maybe talking about a sermon or a speech or something, we could make the statement, this sermon will move people. It will impress people or strike people. And from this, we would be tempted to conclude that the synonyms of move are move, impress, or strike. But does this mean that in any linguistic context, the words move, run, go, impress, or strike are interchangeable? Unfortunately, this is not the fact. Because although we can say it should move through several more drafts, or it should run or go through several more drafts, we cannot say your speech must run the audience, or your speech must go the audience, right? So every human speaker of a natural language would be able to find this mistake. And the same thing about the sermon, right? All articles will impress or strike through copy editing is not really a correct replacement. And this brings into this issue a context sensitivity. We cannot say the synonyms of move are this and that. We can never make such a statement. The only statement we can make is that there is some linguistic context, C1, in which we can interchange move by words like run or go. And the same thing goes for another context. But in fact, this involves some human intelligence, right? We have to understand a sentence. We have to know that an article cannot impress or strike through copy editing because we are humans and we understand the contents of a sentence and are not employing any database to do something on the basis of a formal decision. But what does this all have to do with steganography? Recall the way our encoder works. We have an innocuous sentence, like that sermon will impress people. We have a set of words that can be replaced, like move, impress, or strike can be replaced. And we assign code words to them. So that if we use move in a sentence, then it encodes for 0. If we use impress, then it encodes for 1, 0. Or if we use strike, then it encodes for 1, 1. And now to send a secret, we transmit another sentence. We transmit that sermon will move people. Now, how would Wendy go about steganalyzing this? She will intercept the sentence, this sermon will move people. And now she looks up her database for the correct replacements for move. And she will be confronted with a number of alternative synsets, right? She can she can replace the word move by impress or strike, or she can replace the word move by run or go. And she doesn't know which of these the encoding has originally originated from. So in order to decode the replacement, Wendy has to solve an instance of the AI complete problem of word sense ambiguity. And this is something a computer cannot do, a human can do, and this is why Wendy, who is a computer, will have a serious problem with that. And Bob, who is not a computer, will not have a serious problem with that. So let me conclude by citing that Donald H. Rumsfeld seems to really have understood what steganography is all about. As we know, there are known knowns. There are things we know we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know. And this is pretty much what steganogram is all about. So let me quickly summarize this before I would like to start up a discussion on the topic, what we've seen so far. We've showed that steganography can be motivated by the application of hacker ethics to cryptographic system design. We showed a simple technique to hide data by replacing words in innocuous text by synonyms. We showed how to detect such steganograms using statistic patterns. We showed how to improve the technique so that detection becomes more difficult. And we showed an approach towards making the technique secure against an arbitrator who does not have a certain key in the cryptographic sense. We also showed the less common approach towards making the technique secure against any arbitrator who is not human. What we did not do is we did not review the actual systems implemented so far. We did not review much related literature, and we did not show how to make the technique robust. We did not show how to use our linguistic properties for simple human interactive proofs. But if you're interested in any of those things, then please see the provided references for these things. So these are the references. You can always go to the website bergmeier.cgp.net, and you will find these two nice reports that detail on all of the topics you've heard and all of the topics that I've pointed out before. So thank you for your attention, and I would like to ask, are there any questions? Is there anybody running around with a microphone or something? You can also ask in German. Also, ich bin eigentlich Österreicher und wollte euch nur nicht meinem Stahlstaatslang aussetzen.
Thank you. In the late 17th and beginning of the 18th century, the Catholic Church also used a system of small prayers conveyed by priests. And it was at the same time, well, if you weren't a priest, it just looked like a collection of prayers put into a Bible. But for the Vatican Catholic Church, it was a way of conveying as well as cryptographic messages as well as steganography at the same time.
Yeah, right. There are a lot of ancient accounts, actually, of steganography. Like the Greeks used to tattoo secret messages onto the bald hair of their slaves, and then they would grow their hair and nobody would be able to see that. But all of these things that are like from the Middle Ages or from ancient times can be reduced to pre-arranged settings, right? We have two parties participating in the communication, Alice and Bob, and the first thing they do is they make up an interpretation. And all of these things actually are some account of security by obscurity. The system is secure because no one would think of such an idea or of doing cryptography in such a way, but from experience, from military cryptanalysts and things like that, we actually know that eventually these things are easily broken. And this is why in modern day steganography, we're really trying to do steganography in a small formal sandbox that we can really understand from a mathematical point of view, like in much the same way that we could do cryptography today.
One thing you mentioned, or that you assumed, that if Wendy is a computer, he cannot really understand the language, in that way cannot distinguish that this move on is, for instance, false. I'm not sure if it is really true, because there's this work in the automated translation of language, so computer automated translation. And there's, for instance, one guy sitting at LA University, and he's working on translating by not understanding the language, but just using statistics. So there was this competition from the DARPA, I guess it was. I have to look up the references again. But there they, for instance, had about 1 week or so to translate a language they didn't knew in before. So they had no chance to train the system, and nevertheless succeeded to translate Hindi. And they did this by teaching the system with parallel texts. So the system, over the time, really understood how the sentences are built up, and for instance, even knew common sentences in a special language or so, and could even translate those. So I think it is possible to train the computer to differentiate that things.
Yes, what you're talking about is this. The workshop was called Sense Eval. This is held every year, and they have like teams from all around the world submitting their best word sense disambiguators. So they do exactly this. You have a word, and the word can be used in different senses, and this is the same problem that, of course, they're dealing with in the context of language translation. And in this year's workshop, the best system had a precision of around 72.9%. And there's a figure by Professor George Miller at the Princeton University who estimates that humans agree about word sense in about 90% of the cases. So we have the best automated systems performing at around 72%, and humans performing around 90%, and we have a gap of 20% in between to work with. Now this may not seem like very much, but you have to keep in mind that first of all, we can set up this scenario. So when Alice actually encodes a message, then she can use words that are terribly difficult to decode. She could try the state-of-the-art programs to see whether anyone succeeds upon disambiguating this word sense. And also, this is a problem where these probabilities, like the probability of a system doing this disambiguation task being 0.729, then this has to occur in sequence. Like if we do that for 10 words, then we have 0.729 to the 10th as a probability, and then of course this gap amplifies. So I think it may be reasonable to suggest that in the near future no system will actually be able to approach human linguistic competence as the first thing. And as the second thing, we also know from the linguistic point of view that there are some things a computer cannot understand without solving the ontologic problem to know, like common sense. For example, consider the sentence, "We saw the Grand Canyon flying to Chicago." In the sentence, "We saw the Grand Canyon flying to Chicago," then we as humans know that it is not the Grand Canyon that flies to Chicago, but it is we who fly and we see the Grand Canyon. And these are all of these things. We actually have to know what the Grand Canyon is, that a Grand Canyon cannot fly, and but that we also know that we cannot fly, but we know that airplanes can fly, and that when we sit inside an airplane, then we say we fly, and this is all a huge amount of knowledge that has to be fed into a computer. And there is, I only know of one project currently trying to feed this knowledge to a computer, which is the SIC and the CYC project by Peter Lehnert, and he has I think given up on the idea of doing that with global consistence. So people are already quite well confident about the fact that that nobody will ever succeed in this task. And this is really what I'm talking about in the context of AI completeness, right? If somebody solves this task, then we will have, in the very near future, have a HAL 9000 machine. Okay, any other questions?
I was wondering about your threat model here, which is a computer analyzing large amounts of data, presumably mm-hmm. transmitted over the public internet, or, I mean, you use the example of like a jail, a prison, and a prisoner trying to communicate outside and stuff. But
yeah, this is more just for example. It was, I think, made up in the 70s, so the internet not being such an important topic then, but I think it is a problem right now, because what Simmons actually describes with the prisoners is the scenario that we're witnessing with the Pentagon having their own line in the administration port of your internet provider.
I hear you. But with a kind of maybe a key difference, it seems to me, whereas if you have attracted the attention of the people with that key line into your internet service provider, they're going to treat you very differently, and they aren't going to subject you to Wendy-style automated analysis of your text. They're going to have people using natural language intelligence looking at your stuff. And
do you think that anybody can afford having like 200 apes sitting on the administration port of an internet provider and really reviewing all the mail that goes across this port? And
Right. And that's what I said about if you have attracted the attention. And so we have two levels here. We have a threshold. Well, if you pass it, you attract the attention, and then natural language analyzing mechanisms capable of analyzing natural language are applied to you. And if you have passed that threshold, then we aren't facing a Wendy anymore. We're facing people. And below that threshold, we probably aren't even facing a Wendy. You know, we probably aren't even facing a computer analysis. We're probably just transmitting information over the public internet, and nobody even really cares in general.
Well, I think we are, because it is really easy to be, to use like these statistic phenomena to check for cryptography. Like if this is really true that the French government has actually deployed laws to prohibit the use of strong cryptography, then why shouldn't they use techniques that observe the internet to look for uniform distributions in there? And uniform distribution means that somebody is transmitting a cryptogram. And if you're not allowed to submit cryptograms, then this is actually just a way to enforce law. So why shouldn't they do that on the first hand? And on the second hand, if you say that you're afraid of humans actually doing that, then we have to say that this whole linguistic and AI completeness stuff is about a security setup in which you trust every human being and you mistrust every computer. And of course this is not a realistic scenario, but it is in the sense that that it will not be practically feasible for a human to look at these things, and it is an additional layer of security, because we can do this cryptographic thing that I showed to you with the homophonic cipher and with Alice and Bob sharing a key. But as an additional layer of security, we can do this AI completeness thing. And I think these are really things that complement each other. And I'm not trying to say that that this is better than the traditional cryptography. The cryptography.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I wonder if you worry about even distribution for detecting the secret channel. You also have to worry about detecting the higher ambiguity of the text with the covered channel within. So if you actually can measure the rate which a program can decode a given text of natural language, you will find that a text with the covered channel will be more ambiguous. So Wendy can detect the channel.
You mean that somebody might detect whether the channel uses predominantly ambiguous words, because we have to use ambiguous words to do our steganography thing?
Yes.
There have been attempts to build a computer dictionary, this synonymy thing. There is a dictionary called WordNet containing about 110,000 words that are organized into 90,000 syn sets. So you have 90,000 such sets that say these words are synonymous, and 110,000 words in there. So this means that almost every word is somehow ambiguous. We don't actually notice that when we're using language, because we're intelligent beings. But trying to do things like machine translation or other tasks in computational linguistics, that really got a problem, that almost no word has a strictly defined meaning. And this is why I don't think this will be such a significant issue. And the other thing is that in this context, we are using words that are not synonymous at all, right? In the sentence which I give as an example, Mitchai is a fine little town. We did not use any replacements for the word little. So we can also approach that distribution as long as we can measure it. Any other questions? Or did this answer your question?
Yes. Is there any existing implementations of this thing, the two layers you described, the phonic cipher encryption and then the other approach?
The very simple technique, the one where we really only have the block codes, the binary codes, like 0-1 encoding to the first and 1-0 to the next. This has been implemented by Winstein and by Keith Winstein. It is a system called Tyrannosaurus Lex. He did it when he was 16 and won the Intel Science Talent Search with that. And there has been a master thesis by Mark Chapman. And he did something that is a little bit related to that. There has been no attempt to implement the thing with the variable length codes in the context of word replacement. The variable length codes used to approach a statistic scenario. But this is just a purely theoretical result by Peter Wehner. It would really be interesting if somebody would implement that. And then there is a number of systems like Peter Wehner used context-free grammars to create innocuous words and things like that. And we have an approach by somebody called Mikhail Atala at Purdue University, who actually employed his steganographic techniques to the semantic parsing of a sentence. And if you're interested in all of these details, then please really refer to my report. I review all of this literature, I review all of this software, I think this is a good basis if you would like to start working on that to view that report.
An echelon, the echelon system from the NSA, uses a system for frequency of words. They accept, for example, that the normal human being has a standard vocabulary of 2,000 words. If he's really somebody who's capable of using language, they'll expand their vocabulary to a frequent 10,000 words. So they use kind of a statistic table in which they try to find anomalies in the word use. Do you know anything about that? The frequency.
Yes, this is the basic idea. If you can use unigrams to find these words, like if you use the occurrence of one word, then you might also be able to look at bigrams, like the occurrence of two words occurring consequently. And this is actually a pretty classical thing to do that was done in the old days of cryptanalysis, I would say before all of these RSA and numeric cryptography came up, that an army communications officer had a handbook saying that the combination of the words E and Y occurs in the English language this often. And then these frequencies can be used to actually break this crypto system. But there are measures with which we can actually measure how secure such a thing will be. We only have information theoretically perfectly secure communication system if the key is just as long as the message. And this is, of course, a pretty boring setup for steganography because, of course, always we can exchange like a hard disk with 4 gigabytes of random data and then use XOR to do perfect information theoretic cryptography. But I think this is just the information theoretic scenario, and it's probably the most powerful thing to be doing when analyzing natural language steganography. So you will always find statistic patterns. If you find enough statistic patterns, you will always be able to break the crypto system. The only question is how many secret messages do I have to intercept before I've broken the code? And this is what was actually done in, I think, 47, when Shannon used information theory to deal with crypto systems. But I think it's a good approach in this context.
Okay. First, I would want to say that, of course, this is as an additional layer, this is fine. But I would say, on one hand, this already appeared more or less in some of the questions before. I mean, the first problem is that this is not a clear distinction between solving the AI completeness problem or not solving it, but also but already partial solutions would help very much. For example, if you have some computer system that can reduce the amount of messages that can pass because they are just normal messages, and then you reduce this to say 1% of the message and you give them to some humans that are capable of recognizing strange structures and wrong usage of words and so on, then this is already a problem. Then you're already able to intercept this concept, or you're able to detect encrypted messages. So you do not have to completely solve the AI completeness problem. A reduction would already be fine. And then the second point is that in order to establish systems like that and to use them in less extreme situations than someone being in prison, you will have to use some kind of automatic mechanism, and you're basically into many of the problems of conventional symmetric cryptography again. And for example, either you fix the amount of words, you use some fixed dictionary of sentences that can be used, then you have no key in your system, so publishing it will probably not be a good idea, or you specify some system and then all the sentences used are some kind of key, but this is of course a very, very huge key and so on. So the second thing is you're into problems of conventional cryptography again, and you will probably introduce additional weaknesses once you try to automate, to somehow implement this in an automatic way.
I think you misunderstood one key concept in this context. With everything else, you're right. But you can, of course, publish innocuous sentences. We always had this problem for steganography, that you cannot just give out your innocuous things, and I'm saying this, I'm using this as a steganographic cover. But if we can embed a message into an innocuous sentence, if we know that there are infinitely many natural language sentences, and Alice, who wants to submit a message, chooses one purely at random from her linguistic knowledge, then the probability that a computer will already have this sentence inside any database will approach zero. So the only thing that Wendy must not export is her linguistic competence, right? And this is the second thing that you were talking about. A partial solution would be enough. So if there was one word that the computer can disambiguate, then he has already won the cryptogram partially. So this is a basic difference between the way we're doing cryptography now and the way we were doing cryptography pre-World War II, is that either you have everything or you have nothing. You consider the whole message as a number, and either you can compute that or you cannot. And in this context, it is not like this. But I don't think that this is really such a big problem, because in this context we have to be pretty much aware of the fact that we're using only an additional layer of security with AI completeness. And what we're really doing is we're trying to solve this AI complete problem. And this AI complete problem is about knowledge, about common sense knowledge, and about inputting this common sense knowledge into a computer. So if a computer trying to break such a cryptogram learns to disambiguate one word, then he has won a partial solution. He has found out parts of this cryptogram, but he has also learned how to disambiguate one word, and this will be a valuable contribution to computational linguistics. I mean, if somebody builds up such a database, then we may one day be able to solve this AI complete problem and to really translate natural language natural languages. So this is also one thing that always comes up when we're trying to distinguish between man and machine in the context of cryptographic systems. Either we have a crypto system that is secure, or we have a really valuable contribution to the state of the art that actually posed the problem we're using as a cryptographic primitive. So did this answer your question?
2 points. First is, if you're using code books with synonyms, you're pretty much pretty close to losing control of language, and that differs quite much from the language you're normally using. And I think there are automated programs who can recognize that some text was written by the same author based on idiosyncrasies. And you might notice that this text is different from usual texts this author would normally write. And the second point follows from this. If you employ some automatic disambiguator to help you with, say, 70% of all the ambiguous words, you are forced to use other words automatic disambiguator cannot cope with, which worsens the problem that the steganographic message deviates from the message you would normally send.
The second aspect is, of course, correct, because you're right that you say when we first filter our messages through different word sense disambiguators to see whether they will be able to solve the problem in advance, then of course this will alter our final output of the system. But of course all of these things that came up reduce the security of the whole system. But on the other hand, we can really estimate the security of the system by using, by looking at the, from a bird's eye view, I'd say, on the distribution that we're producing. So let me just... open up this part of my original report. There it is. We are looking at the distribution of covers. We're looking at the distribution of steganograms. And you say that whatever we do in our crypto system may influence, whatever we do automatically in our program may influence the result and may contribute to deviation of these resulting distributions. Then we can look at the probability distribution of all elements that are used by actual native speakers of the language. And we can use the distribution of the steganograms.
And not just any native speaker of the language, just by me. And the stego system is different from the text I would normally produce.
But then Wendy the Warden would have to have statistics for every natural language user.
Well, if I'm in prison,
then it would be pretty likely that they would have some information from me.
If you're using a stick on RAM,
this prisoner isn't using the language he would normally use, then the person is screwed.
Then you train your Stego system on the way you're using your language, and then you don't have that problem.
Okay.
So it's a good thing I didn't have to explain that formula now, because that would have taken a while. So I see people for the next talk already coming in. So I would like to thank you once more for your attention, and if there are any more questions you have or any things that you would like to discuss with me, I will probably be outside afterwards, and of course you can always read the stuff on my homepage, bergmeier.cjp.net. Thanks.